Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 184 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip, and today I am joined by someone I love with all my heart, Miss Paloma Faith. She's great. I love Paloma because she's Paloma. We had a lovely chat just before Christmas. We recorded this. She just put her child to bed, and yeah, we had a wonderful chat about anything and everything with a glow of Christmas all around us. We're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com, where we have loads of good stuff. We've just topped up the POS light blue vinyl. We've got signed copies in the web store now because I jumped on his tour at the end of the year and did merch for him and got him to sign a load for you lovely people to stock up the web store. So that's exciting. Obviously, we've also got scarves and woolly hats and umbrellas and loads of good winter stuff. So head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com. A lot of it is with the slogan of the label, "We may not be for you, and that's fine." Which is, even if you're not into the label, it's a dope slogan, right? You should be getting that merch. speechdevelopmentrecords.com. And of course, the return of We Are Lizards, my legendary club night. On January 27th, the first one of 2018, and we actually come in with a big guest. We've got the legend that is Don Letts. He's going to be spinning some tunes. I'm going to be spinning some tunes in a rubber lizard mask. Stu Whiffin and Chris Glasson from the Hardcore Listing Podcast and Drunkcast will be there spinning some tunes. DJ Destruction, Discotech Credits. It's going to be a good night. Come down to the book club January 27th. Yes, Paloma. I've mentioned a few times when we get into it in the podcast. It's one of the things I was excited about on the podcast was obviously I wanted to talk to her about all the amazing things that has been going on. I mean, the girl's just had a number one album. That's huge. That's life-changing. And a child. A number one album and a child, all back-to-back. So that's hugely exciting. But I also wanted... She's obviously doing a lot of press around that. If you have a number one album, you're on a lot of TV shows, on a lot of radio shows. So what I wanted to also do was talk about stuff that other interviewers can't, of... just times that we've hung out in the past and stuff that we've got up to, how we kind of met, where she was when we started. As I mentioned, I'm sure I mentioned it in the podcast, she was in my second music video, The Beat of My Heart Skipped. And yeah, we've known each other a long time and it's amazing to watch her grow. I swear she's not changed as a person at all, but to see people become opened up to the wonder that is Paloma Faith and to see it exists in stereo as Paloma should always exist is wonderful. So anyway, I'm going to stop rambling. I'll tell you, next week's guest is Guz Khan, who's fantastic. He's, if you've not watched it yet, check out Man Like Mobeen. It's on iPlayer. It came out at the end of last year and was critically acclaimed and praised. It's a wonderful little series on BBC Three. He also did a live at the Apollo on New Year's Eve, which was amazing. I watched that, and then I thoroughly enjoyed looking on Twitter at the praise coming in at him, and then I enjoyed more, because I'm a weirdo, the small number of right-wing idiots who were getting angry about this Muslim man and making jokes and being hilarious and being wonderful. And I love watching idiots get annoyed at nothing. So that was good. But let's get on with Paloma Faith. This is episode 184 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with my guest this week, Miss Paloma Faith. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. That's the bit I have to warn you of. And I was going to warn you specifically because when you and me meet up, we do always speak quite freely and quite openly. So you might not want to get yourself in any trouble. I'm joined by Paloma Faith. I feel, even though we don't have to, I feel I'm having to talk a bit quiet because your little one's asleep.
Yeah, can you hear that shh in the background? That's how I get the baby to sleep.
It's one of them things, isn't it? It's the monitor that shushes. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing, right? How wonderful is technology?
I know, you don't even have to be there.
But you have, you know, you've just,
you've just popped the baby to bed and
new life.
You're in your new house and you're a proper little grown up. How's that feel?
Got a mortgage and everything.
You got a mortgage.
So weird.
You also got a number one album. There's a lot of stuff in there. There's
grown up things.
It's proper grown up stuff. But how
We've
are you
known
within
each
it all?
Other for a long time, haven't we?
Yeah, it's been a good. It's over 10 years, I reckon.
Yeah. So since I think I knew you before I got a record deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I was really desperately trying to get one.
Yeah, I always remember seeing you. I spent ages
desperately trying to not get
trying to avoid record deals. I remember seeing you at Favela Chic. I had to think ages what that place was called. It's one that was on the corner in Shoreditch. I don't know if it's there still. And I remember coming to see you there once after we'd played a few gigs together and thinking, she has to make it because you can't keep playing these tiny pubs with your huge productions and amazing costumes and all sorts of other stuff. I was like, it's not going to work. You've got to be doing arenas and stadiums. So it's kind of, it was nice to see it all grow and go, see, it makes sense.
I feel like now, all my ideas are a bit defunct though, because back then I was doing stuff like going to Dalston Market and buying 2 feather pillows and emptying them onto a stage and putting 2 wind machines facing each other to make sort of a snowstorm.
Yeah.
But if I walked onto the O2 Arena and just emptied a couple of cheap leather feather pillows onto the stage, plugged in the wind machine, people would be like, I think I want a refund, dear Ticketmaster.
I think at your next biggest gig, you should build a small stage on stage. I always remember seeing, I think it was Fugazi once, playing this big venue, and they set up as if they were in the corner of a pub. So they literally filled 3 metres of the stage, just
That's
drums,
sweet.
Amps around each other, and played it like that. I was like, yeah, you could do that. You can build a little
stage within
a grotty pub stage within the stage and then burst out of it. It's perfect. But how have you found that kind of... Because it's been a long journey. You've been doing this 10 years, right? How's that been? Climbing, and because it is an odd industry, it is a cutthroat and brutal industry at times, particularly for a lady.
I feel happy that, I mean, I'm always feeling like the next record's the one that's going to be the end of my career.
Right.
So every time I'm about to put an album out, I just have this few months where I'm sort of planning what I'm going to do if it flops. And I always say it in interviews because it's true. I do think that. And the further along my career I get and the longer I'm in music, the smaller my ideas get and the more I get I don't know what else to do because I've not done anything else for so long.
Yeah.
Whereas at the beginning I used to be oh, it's only been a couple of years. I could go back to that or that. Now I'm just feeling oh no, what am I going to do? Because this is all I've done for 10 years.
Yeah.
So I had a bit of a panic before this album because I was a bit I've had a baby. You know, I am a modern woman. I'm the breadwinner. People keep saying the main breadwinner and I'm no, I'm not the main breadwinner. I'm just the breadwinner.
Yeah.
And I was a bit what am I going to do if it falls through my plan?
Yeah. It's scary, particularly as well because when I met Paloma, you were doing acting, you were doing music, you were doing all these other things. And that's how I knew you as someone jumping into everything. But as soon as the world knows you as Paloma, specifically a singer, there is that thing then, right, that's what I do now.
Yeah,
if this doesn't work,
plan,
how do I swap and change and move?
My original plan was go and do teacher training, but I can't do that anymore because I'd have to wait a good 5 years probably to do it.
Yeah.
Otherwise it would be why is Playing with Faith my teacher?
you weren't as organised as me. I just grew a beard. So as soon as I want to bounce, I just shave and I'm done. No one knows. I can just vanish.
Grow a beard.
I'll give you
to go into teaching. So I'll be
we'll
the
both quit together
lady.
At some point. I'll shave my beard off and give it to you.
Stick it on.
And then we're covered. We can vanish.
My teacher's a bearded lady. Gender neutral.
Exactly. I mean, that's your quote of the of
that's
going to
be my new
moment,
middle name,
it?
Paloma Gender Neutral.
I mean, we'll
just like hip hop acts that have quotes.
Yeah, you have to have a quote. I remember, and this isn't just going to be us reminiscing, but I remember when we were hanging out in LA a few years back. We both happened to be out there at the same time, and I came along to a club that you were going to that had a performing midget that flew along the ceiling at one point. It had a giant lady.
You're going to get me in trouble.
No, it was a lovely club. It was great. But the excitement that you had when you sat down and told me, you said, just speaking of rappers, you said, I met a guy called The Game last night, and he sat down and said, I've sold 20 million records or something, and I live in this. And you said, well, I'm Paloma, and I've sold X amount, and I live in a house in this, and just gave him the rundown. And I was like, it's just,
because I was
he
like,
won't have known what
I
hit
live
him.
In a two-bed in East London, and I've sold about 12,000 albums. And he was like, I've sold 12 million, my name's The Game, I can't believe you don't know who I am. Anyway, I mean, I did say to him as well, because he had like an entourage with him, this big rapper, that some listeners might know who he is, but some won't have a clue because I didn't. And he had like a big entourage of about 15 people that all just laughed at everything he said and agreed with him. And I said, do you pay them not to agree with everything you say and laugh at everything you say? Because it's not that funny. And he was like, you know what? He put his arm around me, quietly whispered, and he goes, they're boring. I want to hang out with you because you're keeping me real. And then he actually put a post of a picture of us on his Instagram. I realised he had about 24 million followers on.
Yeah.
And I was just like, no idea.
All right. Hello, mate. But that's what excites me about it's one of the things that excites me about your continued success is the places that you're going to be that, you know, they're not going to know what's about to hit them or what's going to hit them. Because, again, you are very honest and open, and you're not going to just be like, The Game. Or you're not particularly going to care if someone says, I've sold 12 million or whatever else. You're going to be more, all right, so what are you into? Or, do you know what I mean? Like, rather
what,
than just
what
that.
What about you?
Tell me. Let me look into your soul, you know. So, yeah, that's kind of a nice thing to watch.
It's funny, though, because I often end up in situations with people who are really successful and I don't know who they are because I know that I've got a telly there, but that's just for my mum when she babysits. I don't switch it on. I don't know who anyone is and still don't.
Yeah.
So I'm quite often in situations where, although I did meet Jack Black the other day and I definitely knew who he was.
Of course. How was that?
And his back was turned to me and I went up behind him and I put my arm around him and I said in his ear, I said something like, it's you and me for infinity. Close your eyes and bathe in the seas of our desires. This is forever. This is you and me. This is forever. Dream with me. And he was like, whoa, that was an intro. And he turned around and I go, you have no idea who I am. And he said, no, I don't, but I liked it. And then he shook my hand. And then he ended up singing with me on Chris Evans' radio show.
Amazing. How was that?
Mariah Carey, All I Want for Christmas Together.
Beautiful.
Did you see it?
What a world where these strange comings together can just happen.
Like, oh, I'm really hoping that he would marry me after that, but it didn't work. He didn't even ask for my number.
This time, he's got people. His people can talk to your people. That's how it works when you're famous. You don't actually exchange numbers anymore.
I wanted him to be part of my harem of husbands.
It's good to add to. It's good to build a collection. But there is something in that, because it's weird that I worry sometimes that people who have grown up in a social media world will get this illusion that they've got all these people who know them, therefore everyone should know them, or be insulted if someone doesn't know them. I don't think that's the case. My example is always with I use Ed Sheeran as an example because he's a nice lad.
Yeah.
He's been around at shows I used to do for years. And I'd look and see he's got, say, 30 million followers. That's probably, he's probably got tons more than that, but say it's 30 million. That means there's, what, 6.2 billion who people don't follow him.
Don't, yeah.
So it's like, that's a lot of followers. That's a lot of people that know you, but that's also a lot of people that
don't.
Have, or aren't being
interested
rude.
In what you're posting on Instagram.
And it shouldn't be an insult or anything you get offended by. It should just be like, all right, well, I'll explain. I'm Paloma, I've sold 12,000 records and I've got a 3-bed in East London, you know.
I did meet my new neighbour because I just moved house this morning and I said, oh, very nice to meet you, my name's Paloma. And she said to me, I know who you are. And I said, but I can't assume you do, can I? And she was like, oh, well, that's really nice. And I was just like, but why is that really nice?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want to like... make her feel like weird, so I sort of just smiled because I didn't want to start being pedantic and going, well, why is that really nice? Because it would have been awkward, but it shouldn't be abnormal to assume that people don't know.
Yeah, completely. I think that's absolutely the correct assumption, and then it's nice when you're corrected. Do you know what I mean?
If that's what you're expecting. The situation with Jack Black was really nice because he said, no, I don't know who you are. And then we had a real laugh together because it wasn't based on anything other than just the moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that, again, that's.
But I have
that's
that
real.
Quite
you're
a
not
lot
trying,
with...
or neither of you are trying to impress anyone as such. No. You're just, oh, this person's nice.
I always have that a lot in public, like because sometimes people come up to you and just go, "Can I have a picture with you?" But don't say hello or whatever. Mm. But I always really enjoy it when people come up and. Say like, I wanted to ask what you thought about blah blah, and then I quite enjoy conversation because you know I like a chat.
Yeah, yeah.
So I quite like that when people are like, oh, you said something, and I just wanted to, now I've seen you, I can ask you, like, what was that? And it's quite nice to just have a conversation.
A human conversation rather than just, I need to record this moment.
And put it on Facebook.
In fact, make the entirety of the moment the recording of the moment. Do you know what I mean? Rather than we've interacted and now we're having a photo, the only interaction they want is the photo. And it's like, well...
But we could have had
we
a
could
convo,
have chatted instead. Yeah, exactly.
Photo.
Yeah, we could have engaged and chatted and had a moment as such rather than just... Yeah.
It's more memorable, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's like
completely.
When you do a gig, I always think the best gigs you ever do are the ones where something goes wrong.
100%.
Because that's memorable and then it's how you dealt with it and who helped and... what was said and it always becomes memorable. Like,
yeah,
I was at that gig when all the lights went out and then everyone just used their phones to light it and they did it acoustic for like 12 minutes before the power came on. That's like moving.
Yeah, completely. And it gives you a greater sense of pride as well because you overcome a tough situation and problem because the fact is all the hard work in your career when you get to the point where you've got thousands of people who are there who adore you, the gigs, to an extent, are quite easy because you know how to do it and they want to enjoy it. Whereas if you have things like that...
words, they can sing them.
Exactly that. And if you have that test, though, of, oh, it went wrong, but we did it acoustic and we showed that this isn't... Again, because I always remember all the different setups you've had. It's always been amazing musicians, amazing backing singers and everything. So it's not just a polished pop thing that's appeared out of nowhere. If things go wrong, you've got people and go, all right, well, let's make this work rather than we're just going to wait until we fix the electrics.
The technical fault.
This is a performance and we are performers, you know. Yeah. It's a nicer thing. So how was the whole... in the middle of a music career, deciding to be a mum and taking a bit of a gap to do that?
Well, it was scary, but obviously, like, I wasn't getting any younger, so I just thought, I need to do it or I'll never do it.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted to be a mum since I was about 25, and I've got sort of like a long history as well of being quite a maternal person. Mm-hmm. Like, I've always wanted to cultivate other people's talents and like I've had, you know, several friends that I've known throughout the years or whatever that have ended up homeless live at mine and I always have like a Christmas, for example, where like everyone who hasn't got a family that I know comes round.
Amazing.
I'm just naturally that type of person, and I feel like I was built for motherhood. And I was...
Where do you think that comes from? Was your upbringing kind of like that? Kind of did?
Yeah.
Are you and your mum are close? And did
yeah,
that
my mum's quite. Was quite amazing. Like when I was a kid, I remember we had this woman from Zimbabwe. No, where was it? She was from somewhere in South Africa anyway, living in our house for 6 months because it was when Nelson Mandela was in prison.
Oh, right.
And they were like saying that black teachers couldn't teach in certain schools and stuff. And so... instead of staying there, this woman went on, applied for this thing. And my mum was like, I was only little. And she was like, this lady's coming to live with us until Nelson Mandela's free. And we don't know how long that's going to be.
Amazing.
But she's going to come and teach in our school that I work in. And she's living with us until further notice, sort of thing. And this woman lived with us. And then Nelson Mandela was freed. And I remember it so well because she... was so happy, and then she went back.
Amazing.
And so, like, I was raised in like a life where it was a bit like that. Like, there were squatters on my street. My mum would always drop some Sunday roast round to them on a Sunday. They were amazing punks with mohawks.
Where did you grow up?
In Hackney.
In Hackney, yeah.
And we always had like all the kids from my street in my house.
Yeah,
it was just like that's the kind of community spirit that I was brought up in. So I've always had that
beautiful
feeling that like I'm not singular on my own person. Like I do have a duty to like other people. But then I wanted to be a mother because it sort of never really feels fulfilling like with adults because it's not like 24/7 love.
yeah.
So I did like love becoming a mum. I mean, it was shocking because no one tells you the truth about it, is that it's actually the worst thing you're ever going to do in your life.
Right, in what way?
In the end, well, I didn't really enjoy being pregnant, and then birth was like next level shit.
Yeah. Again, and it is a weird one, because obviously you're saying that you've always felt maternal, but a lot of people, that's something that's part of our society anyway, that you're meant to become a mum, and also that it's this wonderful, beautiful, a blessing, which if then it is this scary or challenging or painful or uncomfortable thing, then you can easily feel as if you're doing something wrong or you're wrong for feeling bad.
Yourself.
Yeah, completely. And you're failing in some way by going, I don't like this, I'm scared, you know.
And it is an innocent that comes along, but the truth of the matter is like all the pictures that they show of like mothers breastfeeding these babies, gazing gleefully up into their eyes, and it's all a connection, is absolute rubbish, because until they're about 5-6 months old, they don't really even see properly, so they can't gaze up at you because they sort of look through you.
Yeah.
So it's not like adoring looks, it's more like looking up and then through you, like you're kind of visible.
And you're waiting for this huge connection and interaction.
Yeah.
That's it. It's all building up to this. The moment the child comes, you're going to have this wonderful connection. If you're then like, oh, this thing in front of me is looking through me or anything else.
It's amazing. But then your heart just grows so much and you just like want to be this most amazing person to this thing. And then like... in my case, I was so sick for so long that I couldn't do what I wanted to do. I couldn't be like dynamic and charismatic because I was ill and I was laid up in bed.
Yeah, that's tough.
And then it takes sort of like 5 months for them to even smile. And even then you're wondering whether it's just wind.
Yeah, completely. You're putting all that pressure on, please just smile. I'll take
that. It is a smile. You're going to your partner. No, I'm sure it's a smile. And they're like, they've been farting a lot. And then you're like, but I'm sure it's a smile. Like, it must be a smile. It looks so much like a smile. And then the doctor's like, no, they wouldn't be smiling at 3 months. That's wind. And you're like disappointed again. But I feel like I turned a corner at about 6 months because then it became really rewarding and things escalate really quickly and I was getting better, able to move around and, you know, be a bit more yourself.
But become yourself again, yeah.
It took me a lot of time to even, like, get back to trying to figure out who I was. And even going back to work was kind of scary because I think I experienced a lot of feelings that most mums going back to work experience, even though it's a kind of unusual situation to be a pop star. I don't think it was that dissimilar to, like, somebody working in an office going back, because you've had this, like, crazy life-changing experience where you're so connected. Like, it's love, but it's also nature crazy connection as well. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, when my baby started sleeping for a certain chunk of time without feeding for the first time, like, I knew that it started to become more regular. So it'd be like bedtime at 7 and then maybe they wouldn't wake up till 1.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just know that you can actually go to the cinema,
right,
with your mate, because
you're
like,
got this gap.
They're not waking up.
Yeah.
And then I remember, like, the first time I did it, and I went to cinema with a friend, and then at 11 p.m, the film had just finished. I walked out the cinema. I said to my friend, "I'm going to go home," and suddenly my boobs just went mental and sort of filled up. Like, I could sort of see them stinging, tingling, everything leaking. And then, like, I just, like, text my boyfriend and was like, "Has the baby woken up?" And he goes, "No." And then 30 seconds later, he goes, "Oh, actually, yeah. How did you know?" And I was like, "My body told me." It's like being a whale.
That's crazy.
Did you ever see that film about the whales, Big Fish, or what was
no.
it called? In Big Fish, there's these whales in captivity.
Oh, yeah, no, I did see. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and they separate the mum and the baby, and they're calling each other from swimming pools.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, I felt like there is a whale that
there
night.
There is that connection there. It's amazing, and it's why it can be tough at points for... It's the different areas of toughness. There's incredible pressure on you as the mum because you've gone through this physical thing. You've essentially done all the work. But then I've got a lot of friends who, as a dad, a year in, were struggling a lot because they felt they hadn't made a connection with their child that the mother had. But it's because there's also this hormonal and physical connection that's there.
And it's love, and it's love a bit, but it's also really weirdly trippy. Like, we don't really know the truth about it. We're basically animals, and we sort of have this weird telepathy as well.
Yeah, yeah. I love it. It's mad. So it's important to highlight, though, that it took 6 months for you to start to feel, as you said just then, to feel kind of okay and in the right headspace and things like that. Because again, I think there is a lot of pressure,
I'm
as everyone says,
really
that
in
instantly, as soon as you see the child's face, it's going to be this or that. And it's like, if you don't have that, the more pressure, the more people are told that, the more guilty you're going to feel, or feel that you've done the wrong thing,
sure,
or made a mistake, or this isn't
that
right.
And are telling the truth.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a mixed bag of feelings, especially the first time. Maybe I'm thinking if I did it again, it might come quicker because I sort of know what I'm doing
now. I understand
it
all, yeah.
But when you're, like, first there, you're just like, oh, this isn't what I expected.
Yeah.
And then no one really prepares you for that. And I asked my mum why. I said, why didn't you tell me that it was so hard? Because I have no doubt in my mind, having now gone through it, that I'm not the apples of my mum's eye. I know I am, but I also, because I know my child is, but I was like, why didn't you tell me how difficult it was?
Right.
And she goes, because no one would do it if you told them.
Right, completely, if they knew the truth.
The other thing is just people go, oh, but would you do it again? And I'm like, yeah, because we're just weird.
No, but that's exactly it,
but
though, isn't it? Because if you know how tough it is, but then you know the other side of that, the connection that then comes and the emotion that then comes, then you can make that rational choice. Whereas if you were told at the start, it's the worst thing in the world. It'll be good later. The people will go, fuck the good later bit. I'm just, I've been put off already. Yeah, let's not go for that. So how was it then returning to performing? Because when we last saw each other, we were both doing a charity thing for
That was the first
one for the boys, and that was your first thing since. And I absolutely adored it. Number one, I don't really do a lot of these charity type things. It's not because I hate charities. It's just because I'm really uncomfortable when these things are a room full of generally
rich
old white men, kind of all eating and drinking and inexpensive clothes.
Yeah.
But we're doing stuff for charity as well. And that's not to judge anyone or say it's wrong. It's just not somewhere I feel comfortable. Yeah. I kind of avoid them because I know the good that they do, but I don't need to be there to improve upon that. But I got there and I had my little rehearsal. I looked at the place settings and your name was next to mine, and it hadn't been announced that you were doing it. So that relaxed me a lot.
Yeah.
But then the other thing was when you actually just took the stage, because I don't know, there was a lot of great performances on that night, but it's a weird situation at an award, not an awards, a charity thing. It's not really a gig set up.
Mm.
It is what it is. And the people who've been on before were very much more from, I guess, that produced pop world, as we were discussing earlier, rather than the performance world. And when you came on, I'd spent the whole time thinking that everyone's doing really good considering the situation.
Yeah.
And you came on and played it as if you were playing Wembley, and you had sass and excitement. And you had a coat that was falling off of your, like the most amazing coat in the world and all this. And it was great to see, because it was like, I could tell what it meant to all of the people around you who knew that this was the first time you were going up there and kind of finding out, I guess, if you're still Paloma. So how was that to jump up there and do it all again? And did it feel good to go, oh,
to be honest,
smash that?
Because it was the first one back. I did feel like I was acting a bit.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of like you get, I don't know about you when you perform, but I feel like when you don't do it for a while, you sort of have to pretend to do it to eventually do it.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And when you start doing that sort of thing every day or every couple of days, then it becomes more natural.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to sort of break the ice. So I was sort of pretending to be myself. I was kind of like acting as Paloma Faith, because I haven't really been Paloma Faith for a while, it felt like. Just been mum.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting, because what people don't understand, there's no falsehood in it, but everyone that performs, it's an exaggeration of themselves on stage.
Yeah,
it's not
you've got
exactly
to take
how they are.
There's a bit of courage involved and a bit of bravery, and you've got to put... And what was really hard about it for me, I think, is that it sort of takes a bit of brazenness to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like to be a really good mum, which I really want to be, you've got to be very soft and kind of nurturing, and you have to open your heart so wide that it's a bit like a net. So if you put a net in the sea to, say, for example, pick up the plastic that's floating in the sea, mm-hmm. trying to do a good deed,
yeah.
the inevitability is you're going to let some fish in, and then you're going to do a bad thing at the same time.
Yeah,
okay, so it's a bit like that with your heart. Like, you open up to be a good mum, and then it means that you're like open up to lots of stuff. So if people are negative, or if people don't act like they're enjoying it or whatever, you feel maybe a bit more oversensitive than normal.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. You've had to open yourself up so much,
so
in the process of connecting with a child and this kind of thing, that
you're
that bit more aware. Whereas when you're young and carefree, you're doing the gig, enjoying it with your mates,
and you're like,
as long as everyone seems to be having a good time, cool, but otherwise I'm having a great time up here.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a bit scary, but also I enjoyed it, because it was nice to do something reasonably low key as the first one. And then I had to go and do another TV show not long after, and that one I was terrified. It's never happened in my career before where they come up to me and said, can you do it again, because you look scared.
Oh really? Oh,
and I
wow.
was like
but oh, that's amazing.
I've got it back into the flow now. So it's just that first bit after like coming back was a bit...
That's really interesting as well, because you are someone who I don't know how long you'd been performing when I first met you, but it felt like you're the most comfortable on stage. It's your home, you've been doing it your whole life. But that gap of I guess in a way, as you said, you've switched from Paloma Faith to Mum.
Yeah.
And it's the only time you've done that. Even if there's been a gap between albums, you've still been Paloma Faith out with your mates or whatever else. So
yeah, and even though I've always been working on the records, whereas this time is the first time ever in my career where I've just not done any music for a period of time.
Yeah.
Because even when I'm not in a public eye, when I go away, it's always been like, it's always been that I've been working in the studio or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas this time it wasn't. So that was a bit difficult. But I'm really glad with the outcome because I feel like the album that I did was influenced by motherhood.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. You spoke of motherhood causing you to have to open your heart up more and then potentially be more sensitive to things. I feel that comes across in the record a bit because it feels like a more, I don't know, more socially conscious, more looking at what's wrong, what's good with the world as well, but what's wrong with the world. I mean, not to sound like I'm your PR agent, but previously, Do You Want the Truth or Something Beautiful was your MO, essentially. You'd create something beautiful. It'd be a beautiful illusion or a beautiful distraction from the world. And this record seems like one that's going, look, let's have a look at some of this stuff. Mm. We can't remain distracted. Like, we can be distracted a bit, but we can't just ignore it all, because that's kind of the people who aren't ignoring it all are probably the ones that we need to be keeping an eye on. If we leave it all up to them, then it's going to be a mess.
And I also feel as well that what's interesting is this album, I've been sort of up against a lot of criticism from the perspective that, like, some people think that I'm force-feeding them my ideas, which I'm not trying to do. I'm just trying to prompt a conversation. Yeah. And then some critics or clever journalists that believe that themselves to be clever have sort of said, she claims it's a socially aware album, could have fooled us because it's so not specific that it almost couldn't be.
Mm.
But I feel like they think that I just didn't do that on purpose. I did that on purpose because I feel like we live in an age in society where basically it's apolitical and younger generations, ours and younger, are basically like, oh, either I just vote for what my mum and dad votes for, or I don't vote, or, oh, I voted for so-and-so because I thought they were funny. Like, people always say that they vote for Boris Johnson because he's funny.
It's not a good reason, and it's like, is it,
not really? Yeah, and obviously then you end up with Trump in power, who's like someone from a reality TV show. And I just feel like you can't come into an apolitical culture and suddenly force feed, like, on your soapbox, you know, who I think is amazing, but you can't go like Billy Bragg or Bob Dylan or whatever in this era, because people will just run away and say, this person's ranting, giving me a lecture, and I don't want to hear it. And it doesn't work. Like, what you have to do is say, I was thinking about this, it's, you know, if you put it in this context, it can mean this. And if you put it in that context, it can mean that, so that people actually don't feel frightened away. And I feel like that could also be perceived as patronising. It's not meant to be patronising. It's just that I wanted to make a socially aware album that's appropriate for this current climate socially.
Yeah.
And the reason why I think politics is in so much, like, of a state, and the social system is so much of a state in the West, it's because it's not been modernized. So people in politics and people, you know, in society are just saying, let's keep trying these old methods and expect people, and it's obviously not working. And then the journalists come out and say that, criticize me for saying it in the way I say it, but I'm like, well, actually, do you know what, like, more people are probably listening to that way of saying it than are tuning into Prime Minister's Question Time, because that is not modernised. It needs modernising. People need to understand what they're listening to. Completely. And they don't. I don't watch Prime Minister's Question Time because I just get so irritated by all the waffle and lack of directness. And also, major lack of empathy. Like, it feels like politics is now just a battle of egos and not about saying this is for the greater good. It's about the individuals representing and saying, not really being prepared to put their own egos to the side.
100%. And like, it's gone that way for a long time. And as you've highlighted Trump as an example there, where it's characters more than parties that are getting in now. And it's the same. It's been the same with our elections for years, because a lot of people who are going out and voting won't realise that they're voting locally in this vote as well. So they're going, I'm voting for the David Cameron or Theresa May or whoever it is. It's like, well, no, you're not. You're
voting local
for
MP.
A guy who lives four doors up the road. Like, what do you think of him? Do you think he's right for your area? It's not just about I'm voting for this one, because one of the biggest illusions is that the power position is president or prime minister or whatever else. One person can't run a country, and there's stuff set up to stop that being the case as well. So, but we do. We get, as you said, we get completely stuck on this idea that it's these characters.
Yeah.
It's Theresa May. It's Trump. It's this. It's that. It's like, or it's Hillary Clinton against Trump. Right. I'm not a fan of Hillary Clinton. I'm not a fan of Trump either. So let's ignore them two and let's look at the two parties and try and get these figures out of the way and not focus on that. But I wanted to touch on one of the things you talked about there. I think you're completely right. I think we've got a real tribalism in society now, where if you bring an opposing view to someone, their instinct will often be to lash out and say you're wrong and you're the enemy and this and that. And I think it happened with Brexit's a prime example of when Brexit happened. There was a lot of reaction, from me included, from people on the left saying, this country's racist. It's like, right, it's not as simple as that. There is a load of racists and they need addressing, but there's also a load of people who were a bit confused. And there were, again, to be clear, there were people confused on the left and the right, because no one explained anything and no one still understands Brexit. But
I mean, I don't think the people in power still understand it.
Exactly.
Because they're a bit like, this is happening and we have no idea how we're going to do it.
Yeah. So I think it's essential. And I'm someone who musically, people have always felt it's very strong-willed and ranting or preaching. If you listen to 90% of my songs, it's exactly as you said. It's presenting a conversation point, a discussion point, and then go from there. People would be surprised how rare I give an actual opinion or view in most of my stuff, because it's like, right, well, no, I feel that I know my views. It's the one place that me and our mutual friend Russell Brand disagree is that, or had disagreed. He's changing a lot more now as well, but I'd always thought, I feel I know what's right for me, but that doesn't give me the assumption that I know what's right for the country or what's right for everyone else. It's why I keep a lot of my political views private and things like that, because it's like, right, I figured it out for me, but I can't pretend to say that I know what's right for a single mum of four in Newcastle.
Yeah, I agree.
What's right for them might be completely different to what's right for me, and it's not fair for me to say, oh, but screw your situation, it's best if we go this way. Yeah, it's going to mean your kids are going to be hungry, but it's best if we go this way. So it's crazy at times to think, oh, I can tell everyone what's best, because you can't experience everyone's experience. So,
but people, and also people keep saying to me things like hilarious things like, I've had people say to me, why are you a socialist? And I say, because I want what's best for the greater good. And then they say, yeah, but that will make your taxes go up.
Yeah.
And I say, yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Because I want what's best for the greater good, and actually believe in paying my taxes to make what's best for the greater good. And I do believe that people who earn more money should pay more tax.
Mm-hmm.
That is inherent in my belief system.
Yeah.
And I just think it's weird that you'd ever vote to not do that, because then you're just saying, like, I've got mine, so screw everyone else.
It's very much the capitalist kind of society that a lot of people, it's not their fault, but it's all we know. That thought of, oh, but some money will be coming out of my pocket, makes people go, like, rich or poor, it doesn't matter who, but it scares people. And it's a weird one. I've mentioned it a few times on the podcast, so I'll be brief with it. But I was reading these essays a while ago that were written just before we decided to go down a capitalist route as a society. So it's killer because it's something I don't think that we could ever go to now, but it would have worked because this guy had the belief that we should just have set prices for everything. So, for example, lamps are £20. That's how much a lamp costs.
Yeah.
Therefore, you can't get a shit one, because if someone makes a shit one, you'll go and buy a good one because they're all the same price. And the same with particular vegetable. They're the same price. So, again, if it's in season, then you'll buy it. If you're having to import it from the other end of the world, you won't, because you're losing money there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it had this setup there that would mean that the quality of goods would keep at a high standard, because again, if they're poor quality, they simply won't sell.
Yeah.
And everyone would have a chance to excel, because although kitchens will cost the same, if you're good at your job, then you'll be busy constantly. If you're bad at it, then you won't be. But it's such a hard one for people to get their heads around, because we all love Black Friday sales or Christmas sales or January sales, because we've been brought up to have this idea of, oh, but I'm getting 50% off.
But you're not. You're basically always just paying 50% more all the time for what they actually have to charge.
100%. 100%. It's such a weird con that we get into.
Just go when it's not in the sales.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, completely. And people don't realise that because of our sale culture, that's built into all prices now, that they're released at a certain price to be able to reduce. I've had that with my web store before, where I said, well, if we sell them at this price, then we can discount them at Christmas. And I was like, well, let's just sell them at the fair price. Let's just sell a fair price. And I get a few people angry because I don't do Christmas sales or Black Friday sales or wherever else. But it's like, no, I don't make enough on my merch to do that. I sell it at what I think is fair. If you want it, have it. If not, that's fine. Again, it's that weird thing of the illusion that we should all be entitled to everything. It's like, no, I grew up and I couldn't have most things because we were poor. I didn't have parents who'd pay for everything. So you'd save up. You can't have it. You can't have it. And yeah, it's a weird part of our society where there is that constant keep hold of what I've got over anything else, rather than, as you said, looking at let's make it the best for everyone. And even not to get too deep and heavy on it, but I think we should be looking globally on it all anyway. This idea of countries, and there's some huge relevance on the bit of dirt that you happen to be born on,
yeah,
is mental. I guess less so with England because we're in Ireland, but so many different countries where there's just someone somewhere drawn a map
and
it's like, well, we're allowed this and you're not, and the people over there are starving and we can't help them because they're not part of our taxes can't help them because they're a different country. It's like, they're literally over there. Like you can see them. You can wave at them. And it's mad. We do have that kind of, that we have to look after our own first.
That I was thinking about when writing
the
album. And that, I think, was influenced by becoming a mother and saying, like, okay, so my kid's going to say, what did you do when you were pregnant with me? And I'm going to go, this.
Yeah.
And then they're going to hear it.
Amazing.
And it's going to basically say, I thought to myself, I need to not only like write something that I like and I'm proud of, but I also got to remember that there's an absolute guarantee that my child's going to listen to this and say, you wrote that when you were pregnant with me, and what do I want them to take from it, basically. So
that's a great point. Yeah.
So the whole thing is about kindness and empathy and compassion and qualities that I think are the most valuable qualities of being a human being, that like I as a parent do not care whether my child's successful in school or whatever. What I care about is whether they're a kind person, whether they're able to empathize with other people, whether they're gonna feel like it's upsetting if another kid hits another kid, like all those things, because that's what I value.
Yeah.
So that's what I tried to do. And then I'm really proud of my website because I just launched it and it's basically like says, help us spread an epidemic of kindness.
Yeah. And people can go on there and there's...
Yeah. And they can look at like... Basically what I wanted to do is I feel like a lot of charity, like you mentioned before, is financial.
Mm-hmm.
So there are bits on it that takes you through to like places where you can get involved with donations.
Yeah.
But mainly they're supposed to be to do with crisis appeals, like things happening right now that need aid. But most of the website is actually about not money. It's about how you can make the world better just on a really small scale and just starting today sort of thing. Yeah. So each section, it's split into like evolution, kindness, empathy and revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Not evolution, environment. And you can go on and then each bit's got like five things you can start doing today. So for example, empathy is kind of like, don't assume that everyone you're speaking to has had a good day. So if you're upset about something, choose your words wisely.
Yeah.
Sort of stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah,
environment's
yeah.
like, switch the lights off when you leave a room. Like, it's really basic, possible stuff.
I like it, though, because there's a range on there of from small to bigger, kind of.
Yeah.
But as you said, there are options to go and donate or go and volunteer or go and do this and that. But then there's also, look, I understand that you're busy as well. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying that you need to quit your job and go and work at a commune. You know, I'm saying, but here's stuff you can do. Yeah.
But let's try. If you can't, then do your little bit. And I feel like it's important to know, for everyone to know, that we're all responsible for the world and it's, you know, each other. So we have to all pull our weight and do as little or as much as we can.
Yeah.
And that might just be a little thing every day. And I think it's important. Like, some of it's like, oh, check on your neighbour that lives alone.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, go and have a chat with them so often. Like, stuff like that's really important because community's sort of a dying thing in a way. And not in some areas, but I always feel really warmed when there is proper community.
Yeah.
And I grew up in a really good community.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful thing because I think for better or worse, the idea of charity has changed as well because it should be a lot of that stuff as well as a lot of the more I'm doing a just giving page. And like there's a lot of charity now that if it's not a social media push or on my Facebook page, then you're not doing anything. There's loads as is listed on your site, that you can just do to do. It doesn't have to be this big, look, everyone vote for me, I'm doing this. It's like,
and lots of people do it without even thinking about it. Like, I know people, you know, my friend you just met, whose family, basically, like, her dad sleeps in a homeless shelter once a week, and he's in his 70s, and he goes and he just has a chat because people just want to have a chat.
Have a conversation,
and some people just haven't, like, it's weird, like, some people haven't been touched in a long time.
Yeah.
Not talking about, like, rubbing up against someone, but, like, just to squeeze someone's hand.
Well, I did a homelessness special on this, and one of the groups I had on were a group called Haircuts for the Homeless, and they just give haircuts to homeless people, and they did it just because they're all hairdressers, and they learnt really quickly that it's a massive deal because that's a really intimate situation because you're touching someone's hair for a long time, you're in close proximity. And they were saying they were amazed to see the change in people, that you're caring to change their appearance, because I don't care what anyone says, appearance affects people.
It does.
If you look good, you feel good for that day. It's so shallow and it's so everything else, but it's rooted into us. It helps. So, but they were saying their idea was exactly that. They'll look nicer and feel better about themselves.
And those were a group of hairdressers that probably thought, we really want to do something, but we're just hairdressers, so what can we do?
What can we do?
Just do what we do.
And that was it. And that's what surprised them, was the thing that meant all the more was having that close interaction. As you said, just being in touch, just being someone who's not going, ugh. Like, all right, let's wash your hair. Let's do this. Let's do that. And just chatting to them and engaging and talking and having a prolonged conversation. Again, how many homeless people are sitting down with someone for half an hour and just chatting? They might have people go, all right, mate, or someone be polite, I have a good day.
But I'm not getting this either from a perspective of like the cliche of, you know, pop star suddenly feels major guilt about success and then wants to suddenly go charity.
No.
I've always...
It's what you grew up with and grew up around.
Yeah, been around it and always been like that, but not in public.
Yeah.
And then I just felt like, because of being a mum, like, literally it's just a message to my kid to say, this is your heritage, like, you come from a line of people that help people out, and I want you to continue that. So it's partly to do with that, but also partly just thinking, like, just planting a seed. I went to see Michael Moore once give a talk, and he said it, and it really rung true to me. He said, the reason why things don't change often is because people think that what needs to change is so big that they're completely powerless in being able to change it. So then they're inactive and they don't do anything.
Yeah.
But his point was, if everyone did a little bit, it's like with charity donations. People don't donate because they go, I haven't got 20 quid to spare. But if every single person that was sent something saying, will you donate to this crisis appeal, donated 50 pence, which is a kind of achievable amount.
Yeah.
How many people are in London? Yeah. Say, for example, 9 million, isn't
it? Yeah.
So if everyone in London donated 50 pence of their money, then you'd make £4.5 million instantly.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of money. So it's just amazing. Like the same as with money, with actions. So if everyone in London changed one thing to make the world better, it would be better.
Yeah, completely. And I think the outlook I've always had, or the easiest way I've always had to sum it up, is changing the world. That's a massive job. That's pretty big. But changing your world is easy. And we all know that from, I said, how different you feel after having a haircut, or putting a good song on. That changes your world. You're in a better mood. Everything goes away. This and that. So you can do more of that to change your world. You can change. You can interact with, as you said, the people on your street.
And also
you don't have to travel the whole country, interact with everyone. You can interact on your street and know that. And then if someone on the next street is doing that, then great. And all it takes is one more on the next street. And it doesn't even take every one of those 9 million, half of them. And you've suddenly got this chain of interaction.
On the website where it says help us spread an epidemic of kindness, I'm also telling myself.
Yeah.
Because I've put things on there that I didn't always do.
Yeah.
And I've only recently said to myself, I've got to do that.
You hold yourself to accountability by doing that?
I am holding my hands up and saying, I want to do it too.
Yeah.
I want to go, I don't need to leave the tap running when I'm brushing my teeth in between. It's so tiny and I feel terrible. I'm like, no, I always leave the tap running. But recently, since I launched my website, I've stopped leaving the tap running.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm like, no, it's not just me preaching and saying to people, do as I do, I'm perfect and I'm an angel, because I'm not. I'm just saying, this is so easy to do. I want to do it, and I hope other people do it as well.
It's mad though, isn't it? Because it's proper mum and dad stuff. It's like, turn the light off when you leave the room. Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, maybe I should have done that. As a kid, you're like, oh.
Yeah,
they're just nagging.
Like,
it's like,
no, actually.
Oh, no, I could have done that and it would have made a difference.
You watched that David Attenborough?
I've not watched any of them yet. I was away when they started the new Blue Planet one.
Blue Planet 2. Yeah. So last night was an episode and he was just talking about the sea, and he was saying, like, all these beautiful birds that they had on there, aardvarks, were like swallowing plastic.
Yeah.
And this woman took some of the plastic and showed you what it was. And it was like a rice packet and a bit of cling wrap and it had regurgitated it, but some of them don't.
Yeah.
And just stuff like that. It's like, oh, do you know what? It's just so sad.
It's the assumption that, number one, it's the assumption that no one else will do it. So why bother? And also, it's the assumption that it matters what the fuck anyone else is doing. That shouldn't lead why you're doing stuff. Well, it's not worth me doing it, because unless we all do it. It's like, fuck everyone else.
Do it
because it's right for you to do it. Yeah. Not because you're going to change the world or this, but because it's the right thing for you to do.
It's true. I watched this TED Talks as well, which was some of them are really good. And it was talking about it being a sort of people starting to worry about doing kind things.
Yeah.
Because they're saying, like, oh, I've stopped doing that because it feels like it's more for me than it is for the person I'm helping.
If the result is good.
Yeah, and then it's like, well, what's wrong with saying, I feel really good because I went out last night and gave, you know, 100 sleeping bags out to homeless people sleeping in the cold in this winter, which is about to freeze over.
Yeah.
Do it anyway. Like, do you know what? Do go out and give those 100 sleeping bags and then feel good about what you've done afterwards.
Yeah.
Because you should feel good about it because it was a good thing and it was nice.
Yeah.
And there's no shame in feeling nice about doing nice things
and
for people.
And the thing you could do to feel good is
helping.
Sit and watch a film and eat ice cream. That's not going to help anyone else. That's great because it does feel good, but it's not going to help anyone else. So if you're going to do something to make yourself feel good, do the one that helps someone else as well.
Anyway.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. The guilt will see a bit of it. Before we forget, what is the website address?
Oh, it's playwithfaith.com.
.com, that's perfect. I'll start to wrap things up as we're at an hour and I want you to be able to eat and relax and enjoy your evening. I do want to... Because we were discussing it just now, and it cracked me up when all the furore was on social media, talk about gender neutral and so on and so forth. Because there was this huge uproar that you're raising your child gender neutral. Number one, the huge uproar is hilarious to me because people are getting angry about someone they'll never meet, something they have nothing to that is nothing to do with them. But the thing that made me laugh more was discussing it with you when I got here, that it's you're choosing not to share the gender of your child
in the public.
Yeah, anything other than
that
is no one's business.
The gender of the child.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just because I just want my child to have a normalish, as normal as they can life.
Yeah,
and I don't want them to feel under sort of like the public eye or whatever because.
Yeah.
Because I think that it takes a certain character to be able to be resilient enough to deal with that.
Yeah.
And that's not a default setting of being born to somebody who's chosen that for themselves, which I have.
Yeah.
My child may or may not grow up to find it either intimidating or threatening or scary or... overwhelming and not want that attention.
Yeah.
And I just feel like, you know, I sort of advice about it. It doesn't come from nothing. I spoke to someone who deals with child protection as a profession.
Yeah.
And their advice to me was like, you need to basically give as little information about your child in public domain as you possibly can.
Yeah.
In order to like make sure that people don't know who they are and don't.
Yeah.
You know, impose that on them if that's what you want. And
yeah.
I was like, that's 100% what I want.
Yeah,
so
they can develop naturally and decide what... it's not
they
a gender neutrality thing. It's a whole neutrality thing. It's deciding what they want to be.
And they might be gay and they might be straight, but they also might be super shy and super, like, normal and straight and heterosexual and want to work in insurance on the phone lines and not want people to know who their mum is.
Yeah, yeah.
And just like want to do anything, but I just don't want to restrict that. So I feel like it's kind of mad, a combination of kind of media sensationalism and
completely media sensationalism. I said, oh, when I saw the headline and then read the actual quote from you, and the actual quote from you was talking about how you don't want to have toys that are gender specific,
yeah,
kind of thing, that are here's the blue for the boy and the pink for the girl or so, yeah, on and so forth. That was all the quote in that article was.
And then it was
then this big thing of,
to be honest, are raised like that now.
Yeah, 100%.
Like I've seen little boys in the park all the time carrying dolls.
Yeah.
And I see little girls going, Nina, Nina on a fire engine. So that's pretty standard in terms of raising your kids nowadays.
It's no great shock, but what the reality is, it's, so rather than saying, I want my child to have the choice of what gender they are, you're saying, I want my child to have the choice of what everything they are. If your child at some point decides it wants to be the child of Paloma Faith and wants to be a
public
celebrity child
it.
And public and this kind of thing, then they will have that choice,
and
right?
They can
when
do
they're
that
an age
when
that
they're
they
18,
can.
But not before because they might regret it.
Exactly,
before.
Yeah, completely. So when they're at an age to make those decisions rather than. Because it's a bizarre one that celebrity is the one thing that we feel people shouldn't have the right to have a choice on.
Well, I think it's also
that it is
because
that people say, well, it's the Beckham's child. They're famous. It's like, well,
but
no.
I think it's because people see celebrity as they can't understand why anyone wouldn't want it.
Oh.
And I feel like it's
which
so
terrible.
Desirable, but actually it doesn't suit a lot of personalities.
Completely.
And even I, who you know, as you said earlier, sort of always seemed like I was up for it.
Yeah, yeah.
I struggle with certain elements of it, and I'm not complaining because I feel like every job you ever do has got pros and cons. Like, I know doctors who are like, I love my job because I save people's lives, but it's really difficult on the NHS at the moment because of the cuts and all the paperwork, and all you really want to do is, you know, same people who work in education, and they're just like, feel like the majority of their time spending filling out forms rather than teaching kids to read, and their hands are tied and that sort of stuff. And then, you know, it sounds mad, but being a pop star is, there are some annoying things about
completely.
It. And it's not about me complaining. It's just, you know, it just is what it is. Any
it's
job.
It's a job. It's hard. It's a hard job, but it's, and it's a job I like any other. I always remember when I was seeing a girl in America who was far more famous than me and had paps and stuff all the time. And it confused me at first that all of her friends were famous, but from different areas, from acting, from music, from art, from all different things. I thought, that's odd. And then I realised it's because they're the people that she can say, oh, I'm so knackered at the moment, and not have them go, you kidding? You got the dream life. You got the dream job. You're touring the world. You're doing this and that. It's because she can relax and say, I'm really burnt out at the moment, without people going, mate, I work in an office. Because again, every job is hard in a different way. So it's not acceptable for a pop star to say, I'm really struggling at the moment.
That's going back to what we were saying. It's like, I don't want to put that on my child, because my child might say, that's not for me.
Yeah.
And how can I get out of this once it's already done?
Exactly. Once it's locked in.
Yeah, and also you've decided that for me, and I sort of hate you for it.
And I think you're right. It's the misperception that I want to be famous. And that's such a weird thing in society now. And one that I argue it a lot, because people will say, people who are an example of something that you've been involved in, so I'm sure you would have seen a lot of love and a lot of backlash of reality of music shows, a contest. People will say, this person is known all around the world. They're world famous for going on a stupid singing show, whereas there's a scientist over here, no one knows who he is. And my argument is always, that scientist doesn't give a fuck if anyone knows who he is. Because he's not sitting there thinking, I'm the best in the world at this and I'm saving lives. But what I'd really like is to be famous. It's like, it's that illusion that fame trumps everything. I guarantee that this scientist who's saving lives and changing the world is going to bed feeling so pleased with himself and proud of himself. He just doesn't need, he's not thinking, if only I could sing on a stage. You know, that's not the reality. But we do have that weird perception that who wouldn't want fame?
I think I know what kind of people want to be famous. And I think what it boils down to is like a weird type of insecurity that demands, and it's like an addiction. So it's a void that will absolutely never be filled.
Yeah, yeah.
That basically is like, okay, so in order to feel like a whole person, I need 20,000 people a night to validate my existence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a severe psychological problem.
It really
literally
is.
Like, you feel like less of a person when you haven't been clapped at for like a few weeks, and you're
completely,
like,
completely, it's an addiction.
I feel
as
unvalidated.
Well.
I feel lost.
Because like
know.
Any addiction, though, it dilutes. Like, you're doing a tour, and at first it's great, and then you're like, well, I remember getting a message halfway through a tour, or I was getting messages every night saying, how was tonight's gig? And about four nights in, I'd say, look, just stop asking, because it was good. It was cool. I've not got a unique story from every gig. Like, this is my job. I'm doing this every night. So it is that weird thing that it does become, yeah, yep, it was lovely. All I can tell you is the location, pretty much. Unless, as you said, something weird happens or bad happens. But it is that weird thing that you get that validation, but then that validation becomes the norm. So do you need greater validation? And, the
and
trappings
then
of this industry.
Yeah, you completely, like, get stuck. And then you're like, I want more now. So now I want to do 200 people. Then I want to play to 1,000 people. And then I want to play to 8,000 people. And I still don't feel confident. Why don't I feel confident? Yeah. I'm sure 10,000 people will help me feel confident. Yeah. And then you're just like, no, I don't feel confident. And then you're like, 20,000 people's got to make you feel confident.
How have you handled the celebrity side of success? Because there is a side, and it's often so much more for women, that there is a side that is nothing to do with you smashing at a gig or your talent. There is a side where it's what you're wearing and where you are and how you look and things like that. Was that something that you had to get used to, or get ignore the compliments as well as the insults or whatever else? How did you kind of adapt to that? Or have you ever adapted
to
that?
No, I'm still not really good at it.
Because you are someone who's always worn very outlandish and outrageous outfits. So you were, even when you were climbing on the venue or audience size scale, you were getting a lot of attention for how you looked and how you appeared and you stood out of things. So how was that kind of that extra spotlight, I guess?
I just think it's weird that people don't realize that I'm doing it tongue in cheek. Like, I feel like it's weird when people say, "What the hell has she been wearing?" and puts me in a column like that, because it's like, I know.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
How mental's this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a bit weird, but I feel like there's a massive pressure on women to like be attractive, and I find the most common tweets that I get are hilarious, and it's so weird that so many people tweet me saying, it's men saying, "Is it bad to admit that I've got a secret crush on Paloma Faith? I know she's a bit weird."
It's just bizarre, isn't it?
And it's like, I don't know how to take that, mate. Like,
no. People just say the weirdest shit like that, as if that's acceptable.
Quite a common one for me to get. It's like, "My guilty pleasure, don't tell my mates, but my crushes."
That's horrible though, isn't it? That's horrible, because it's not, it's they're thinking that the great compliment of
their affection,
Barry from Southampton being attracted to you, outweighs the insult of saying, "Oh, don't tell anyone," and this and that. It's like, that's fucking bizarrely arrogant and strange to have that perception, right? I'm kind of insulting someone, but I'm also giving them the blessing of my affections. And
I feel like it sort of boils down to it boils down to the fact that the truth is what makes someone attractive is not what we're told socially. What makes someone attractive is not necessarily like being skinny or wearing thigh-high boots and a revealing top. It's confidence.
100%.
And it's like saying, "I'm this and I am, I accept myself."
Yeah.
And so therefore you're attractive, really. So it's sort of like, it's confusing to people, because they'd be like, normally I wouldn't like a girl wearing a hippo dress, but for some reason
there's something there. I completely agree, and I wish that there was more acknowledgement and acceptance of that. The amount of times at small gigs or big gigs I've just been in complete awe of someone because of their talent and skill as a singer. Three or four times it's been a backing singers of yours at some point that I've been like,
"They're amazing, aren't they?
Who is this person?" And then again, it's not a sexual thing. It's not a creepy thing. It's just like,
wow.
Because you're someone who's always given them the forefront as well. It's not a backing thing. There will be points where it's their show as such.
Yeah.
And it has been, there's been things where it's like, obviously, I know Paloma and I know how talented a Paloma is, but it's their moments when someone catches you off guard who you've never had any experience of, and you're just like, wow, that's the most beautiful and amazing thing I've ever seen. And that should be highlighted more than a photo of someone that's been photoshopped or at a really good angle or whatever else, you know?
I know. Anyway.
Well, there we go. Well, thank you very much. I'll wrap things up there. It's been lovely to catch up.
Sorry about all the kitchen sound effects.
No, it's good. I like it. It's the exciting backdrop of a working home. It's reality. Well, thank you very much. And where can people keep up to date on everything? On social media, I guess.
Yeah, right? Social media and my website.
And the website, which has got, it's definitely worth a visit.
But not with an F. th.com.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much. Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobish Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Paloma Faith. I was obviously hugely excited to catch up with my pal. And I hope you all enjoyed that. If you did enjoy that, we've had loads of good guests in the past. People that me and Paloma know, Laura Dockrill, Gemma Carney, loads of people, loads of good guests. So I hope you enjoyed that. I'll be back next week with the wonderful Guz Khan. I think I might. I'm recording a lot of podcasts at the moment, and the order is forever at risk of changing. But at the moment, the plan is Guz Khan next week. I might move that about. We'll see. But I hope you all enjoyed that, and I'll talk to you in a bit. Thank you for tuning in, guys. Oh, I should mention the club night's back. I'm returning with my crew and the We Are Lizards club night on January, when is it, 27th? I'm scrolling through my phone to look for the artwork and speaking in a slightly high-pitched voice. Here's a little thing for you while I'm searching for the artwork and the exact date. I'm now, right, going to tell Buddy Peace, who puts together the podcast for me, I'm going to tell him to cut in a bit of me talking about the club night at the beginning of this podcast and at the beginning of last week's podcast. Now, I forgot to mention it, but the beautiful part is it's going to have gone in, you're going to have heard it, and now I've just revealed it's all smoke and mirrors. And he snuck that in. So it's on January 27th, and we're joined by the legend that is Don Letts. It's at the Book Club. Come down, 8 till 2 a.m. We've been lucky enough to have sold out nights there for 5 years now. They get rammed. There's a queue jump list. If you send your name and the name of anyone you want on the list to info@thetrashsociety.com. That list is actually run by Stuart Riffin of the Hardcore Listing Podcast. So yeah, come down. We'll see you then. Other than that, I'll see you in a bit. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.